Scripture reading for tonight is from Exodus chapter 35, verses 21 through 29. And they came, everyone whose heart stirred him, and everyone whose spirit moved him, and brought the Lord's offering to be used for the tent of meeting, and for all its service, and for the holy garments. So they came, both men and women, all who were of willing heart, brought brooches and earrings and signet rings and armlets, all sorts of gold objects, every man dedicating an offering of gold to the Lord. And every man with whom was found blue or purple or scarlet stuff or fine linen or goat's hair or tanned ram's skins or goat skins brought them. Everyone who could make an offering of silver or bronze brought it as the Lord's offering, and every man with whom was found acacia wood of any use in the work brought it. And all women who had ability spun with their hands and brought what they had spun in blue and purple and scarlet stuff and fine twined linen. All the women whose hearts were moved with ability spun the goat's hair. And the leaders brought onyx stones and stones to be set for the ephod and for the breastpiece, and spices and oil for the light and for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense. All the men and women, the people of Israel, whose heart moved them to bring anything for the work which the Lord had commanded by Moses to be done, brought it as their free will offering to the Lord. The second reading is from Exodus chapter 38, verse 8. And he made the laver of bronze and its base of bronze from the mirrors of the ministering women who ministered at the door of the tent of meeting. The word of the Lord.
Good evening. We are doing this lectionary this year of women in the Bible because as some of you may have noticed that in the usual lectionaries, there's very little stories where women appear. And so we decided, particularly after the horrendous treatment of women and people of color and all kinds of people came to the flagrant surface, not that it hasn't been going on forever, but came to the flagrant surface during the campaign and in the election, we decided as a community of a number of us that this would be the best thing to do because it matters. It matters a lot. So what I'm going to start with is reading you a very short story that is I did not write. It's written by a Jewish woman named Jill Hammer. And it's from this book, All the Women Followed Her. A collection of writings on Miriam the prophet and the women of Exodus. When the Israelites received the Torah, they did not at first know what to do with it. Parts of it were law, parts of it were story, parts of it were poem. They began to read it and discovered that every time they read it, it had a new meaning. They also discovered that the new revelation seemed more clear if they studied it together. The people were occupied with the task of building the tabernacle and all its furnishings as a dwelling place for God. Yet they also knew that it was an equally important task to study the words which they had been given at Sinai. So at night, when the work of building the tabernacle had ceased for the day, the people began to gather in groups to learn the Torah together. Miriam, the prophet, called to the women who had worked hard all day to spin blue, purple, and scarlet thread for the tabernacle's curtains. They wound their threads into skeins and came to sit at Miriam's tent. She taught them the Torah for hours until their eyes drooped. The very beginning of the Torah fascinated them. They spent many days on the 6 days of creation, probing its mysteries, for they too were engaged in the work of creation. Finally, when they came to the creation of humankind, the women became confused, for they had read this verse: God created the Adam in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. They argued about the meaning of this verse. How could God create one creature that was also two? How could God create a mortal creature of any gender in God's own image? They had seen on Sinai that the eternal was a consuming fire. No mortal could approach that presence and live. Miriam listened as the women argued. The debate grew more and more heated. Finally, Miriam said to her disciples, "Go home and fetch your mirrors." The women did not understand this strange request, but they hastened to follow Miriam's bidding. Each went to her tent to find the mirror into which she looked when she braided her hair or painted her eyes. Some opened carved chests of olive wood given to them by their mothers. Some unwrapped bundles of rags. Some begged from neighbor women or from grandmothers. Some brought two or three mirrors so that others could share. Soon, all came back to Miriam's tent carrying the precious bronze circles. The firelight reflected in the many mirrors made the tent blaze like a palace of light. Then Miriam told the women to look into their mirrors. "What do you see?" she asked. "I see myself," each woman answered. "I see my eyes, which reveal my soul. I see my mouth, which speaks and sings. I see that I am different from everyone else." "Each of you is made in the image of God," Miriam explained. "Your soul and your speech are like God's, and your body is God's dwelling place. Each of you embodies the divine presence in a different way. When you look into your mirror, you see a woman, but you also see the divine image. If a man were to look into your mirror, he would see a man, but he would also see God. This is what the Torah means when it says, God created the Adam in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God is like the mirror. God remains the same, but reflects each of our images differently. Men and women, young and old. This is why, when we study together, we can reveal different facets of the Torah to each other. Each of us is a different reflection of the one. The women were silent, and for a long time they looked into their mirrors without speaking. Then one of the women said, "These mirrors are holy now because each of them has held God's image. We can no longer use them for ourselves. They belong to everyone." Some of the women were angry at this, for their mirrors were precious to them. But another woman said, "The people are all donating their most precious possessions for the building of the tabernacle and its instruments. Let us give our mirrors to become part of God's dwelling place. Then their holiness will be honored by all the people." Miriam smiled, for she was very pleased by what her students had said. Then Miriam said, "Let the mirrors be used to make the bronze laver, which the priests will use to wash their faces and feet and hands. At each washing, they will look into the water, and they will see God's image. In this way, the mirrors will teach the priests what they have taught us." Even the most grudging of the women consented to this plan, and each one gave her bronze mirror to be smelted for the priestly laver. And when the tabernacle finally was finished, Moses arranged the tabernacle, its curtains, its altar, its incense, and its lamp. The divine presence settled upon the tabernacle and shone radiantly through the camp. The women gathered and peered into the courtyard where the polished laver stood before the door of the tent of meeting. They made a covenant with one another to return again and again to the door of the tent of meeting, to pray, to study, and to see their faces in the basin made from their mirrors. And in that company, Miriam was often heard to teach. On account of the one God's many images is the eternal called Adonai Tzavot, Lord of hosts. And some say Adonai Tzavot, God of the women who serve the divine dwelling place. that's been one of my very favorite stories for a long time. Miriam is, I have Miriam tattooed on my arm with her hand extended with the timbrel when all the women followed her through the Reed Sea when it was parted. It was in, you know, I imagine standing there and the waters part and everyone's like, are you going through there? I'm not going through there. Are you going through there? Right? And it took somebody to say, you know, to lead, to be the person who said, who trusted and said, follow me. And they did it with dancing and singing, even though they were fearful and they could have died. They did it with dancing and singing. So in this story and in the Bible passage that we heard tonight, they're building the tabernacle. And so the Hebrews, the Israelites, had been slaves in Egypt for 500 years. And so you might ask yourself, where did they get all of this gold and silver and copper and jewels and all that kind of stuff? Well, there's a little sentence in Exodus 11, verse 2, where the Israelites are instructed to ask their Egyptian neighbors for silver and gold items before their exodus from Egypt. And I think that that's really kind of an interesting thing, because it seems to me that it might mean that there were Egyptians who cared for the Israelites, who saw them as neighbors. And in fact, in Exodus 22, it says, and you shall not persecute an alien, and you shall not oppress him, because you were aliens in the land of Egypt. And so I think that that implies that there were Egyptians who were not oppressing the Israelites, the Hebrews. Now, the systems, of course, were in place, just like they are today, of oppression for all kinds of reasons. And there was that piece that was important. So again, they've been slaves in Egypt for 500 years, and now they were going with their whole community to the Promised Land, and they were going through the desert. And they needed to learn how to be a community in freedom, because they hadn't, in, you know, 500 years is a long time. And so I think that perhaps God gave them, I don't think God needed a tabernacle. I don't think God needs churches. I think we need them because we need places to come together in community. And so perhaps the process of building the tabernacle is what brought the people together in love and community, and remembering that there were people, even when they were in slavery, who loved and cared for them and gave them all these jewels and this gold and everything that they were building. So they were building their tabernacle, their most holy place, not only with their things, but with Egyptian, right? Their Egyptian friends had helped build their most holy place. So each person contributed what they had for the community, and giving up some of what they had and what they held for the community. So I think that when I think about the tabernacle, or I think about the church, the buildings that we meet in, it seems to me that, you know, I have a relationship with God individually, but for me, I don't think that the relationship is fully realized unless it also happens in community. That's one of the reasons why I feel so incredibly blessed to be a member of this community, to not have to feel like there's anything I have to fight when I come in here, because I feel like I do that in most places in my life. And so I don't have to fight just to be seen or just to be heard or just to be reflected in the lectionary or in the sermons that people give. And so I think that connection, the tabernacle, as they were building that tabernacle, they were bringing everything together, and they were bringing themselves together. And if we look at, you know, we were created, mammals in general, and humans in particular, were created biologically for connection. We have hormones, right, that run through us for connection. And so when babies are born, there's an increase in oxytocin in both the mom and the dad. And oxytocin is what they call, you know, some people call the love chemical, right, or the connecting chemical. And what it does is it increases our want to some people call to tend and befriend, right? So to care for and to be friends with other people. The other thing that happens is that in fathers, vasopressin increases. And what vasopressin does is it suppresses the part of testosterone that feeds aggression and doesn't suppress the part of testosterone that is about protection. And so oxytocin also has a protective aspect to it. And so right when children are born, and there's a little bit of evidence, I didn't see a lot on this, but there's a little bit of evidence that happens in adoptive relationships too. And so we have this biological wiring, this biological soup running through us for connection. And some of the things that increase oxytocin and vasopressin, even in adults, is skin-to-skin contact. And when I look around in our culture, and it's so incredibly sad to me that there's so much physical separation. You know, you go to places like India or Ireland, or, you know, people are they're just physically a lot closer together. But there's a lot more touching, and people, you know, touch when they meet, they touch their hands. But that increases our oxytocin. And there's even some studies where when infants are ill, and if the mother or the father has skin-to-skin contact with the infant, the infant's heart rate and temperature will start to regulate because of the adult of the parents being regulated. It's like an amazing thing. And that's true for any caregiver of an infant, any caregiver of, and they haven't, I haven't read any studies where they've done that with older kids. But I'm guessing that if not that dramatic as in infancy, because everything's dramatic in infancy, there is some of that goes on throughout life when we touch each other, when we connect with each other. We're also neurologically wired to connect, and not only to connect, but to repair. And so we have a neurological drive when there's a break or a rupture in relationship to come back to it, to come back and to repair it. And we live in a society that does not support that. We live in a society that says if there's a rupture, make it bigger, right? And so how do we stay with how we were designed, you know, how God designed us to be? How do we stay with that? How do we learn how to do that better and better? How do we unlock that potential within us? And I think part of that is the tabernacle, is the church, is the coming together in this environment. There's also research on, it's in the area of neurotheology, where ritual, so doing the same kinds of things over and over and over again, singing songs together in a place of sacredness, actually shifts the part in our brains that tells us that there's a separation between you and I. And so it kind of turns that off. And so we actually experience neurologically less barrier between you and I. And so there is a bigger feeling, or the potential for a bigger feeling of, like on the quantum level, of course, we're all, there's no difference between us, you know. we're just all quantums interspersing with each other, right? And so when we do ritual, when we do things over and over and over again, that enables us to have this feeling of connection. And I think God lives in that place. And I think that that's a place for me that I allow more of who God is in to who I am. We also learn best and grow best and develop best in the context of caring, compassionate communities. And again, I just feel so blessed to be a part of this community and some of the other communities that I'm a part of. Because when you are in a caring, connected environment, your brain doesn't have to worry about stuff. You don't have to be fearful. And unfortunately, again, most of us have grown up in systems of education that are based on fear. And so when you have to pay attention to fearful stuff all the time, it decreases your capacity to learn and grow and connect. And so it seems to me that we were designed by God to live in community with love and care. And I think because there is fear in the world, and there is destruction in the world, and there is violence in the world, that's why we need God's grace and mercy. So that we can, it's almost like a Control-Alt-Delete, you know? It's like, gotta come back to center. So we can connect again and see each other. I recently had a conversation with two good friends and colleagues of mine, and we're all psychologists, and one of the women is Muslim and the other is Jewish. And so we were talking about teaching students in the helping professions about how to incorporate religion and spirituality into the work that they do with clients. And it was interesting because all of this fighting that gets set up as a religious issue between particularly Jews and Christians and Muslims is not about religion, because we all come from the same place. We all have the same God, and that was the new thing, was the one God. And so I looked a little bit, I was thinking as I was putting this together and thinking about community, I was thinking, like, who are our neighbors? You know, when Jesus was asked, what's the greatest commandment? To love God with all our heart and all our mind and all our soul, and to love our neighbor as ourselves. And so the greatest commandment is to love God and love your neighbor. And so who is our neighbor? Who are our neighbors? And where did Jesus get that idea? Well, Jesus got that idea from growing up hearing the stories in the Torah. Because that idea is repeated over and over and over and over again. In fact, in Exodus, where the Israelites were told, you know, don't punish the alien, don't be mean to the alien, because you were an alien amongst the Egyptians, right? Who is your neighbor? In Exodus 12, it says, there shall be one Torah for the citizen and for the alien who resides among you. Just one for everyone, no matter who. In Leviticus, you shall not persecute him, the alien who resides with you. You shall be to you like a citizen of yours, and you shall love him as yourself. Does that sound familiar? In Deuteronomy, you shall not bend judgment of an alien. You shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and Yahweh your God redeemed you from there. On account of this, I command you to do this thing. And again in Exodus, if you see the donkey of someone who hates you sagging under its burden, you would hold back from helping him. You shall help him. So basically the word reah, which is the Hebrew form of neighbor that's used in Torah, that word is used over and over again, and it's used to refer to an Israelite, a Canaanite, an Egyptian, and actually in the story about the Tower of Babel, it is used to refer to everyone on earth. And so who is our neighbor? Well, our heritage and our tradition would tell us that everyone on earth is our neighbor. So I ask myself, what am I willing to give up for the life and connection of our community, for the global community? And not just give up, because sometimes we give with expectation. And in my experience, expectations are resentments waiting to happen. And so how do we give without expectation? And then once we give, how do I become willing to open to receive whatever is there? I don't know the answers to those things, but I think they're really good questions. So I would like to leave you tonight with a prayer that has been really close to my heart since I can remember. So pretty little. And it's the prayer of Santa Teresa de Avila, St. Teresa of Avila. And even if you didn't grow Catholic like I did, Teresa of Avila was a remarkable woman. She lived about 100 years into the Spanish Inquisition, the burning times, where hundreds of thousands of mostly women were burned, put to death for heresy, for being witches, where they eliminated, and it lasted for 500 years. And so generations of wise women who were healers and spiritual leaders were eliminated. And for a lot of us in the room here today, that's our heritage. Those are our grandmothers from Europe. And so 100 years into the slaughter, in Spain, which was the seat of the Spanish Inquisition, she started writing, she reformed the Carmelite order, and she was a mystic, and she wrote many books. And so this is in the 1500s, right? Women weren't allowed to do any of that stuff. And so she was a mystic, and what she wrote about and taught about and was almost put to death for was the grace of God, that God was about grace and mercy and not about rules and regulations and getting it right and there only being one way. In fact, she's she was known to have said many times that contemplative prayer was nothing more than a sharing between close friends. And so she actually, I learned when I was looking up some of this, when I was reading some stuff for this, I learned that she's actually pretty revered by Lutherans, also because of what she wrote about grace and mercy. And my guess is that Luther probably read some of what she wrote, though we don't, that's not documented anywhere. So here's the prayer that I would like to leave with you today. May today there be peace within. May you trust God that you are exactly where you are meant to be. May you not forget the infinite possibilities that are born of faith. May you use those gifts that you have received and pass on the love that has been given to you. May you be content knowing you are a child of God. Let this presence settle into your bones and allow your soul the freedom to sing, dance, praise, and love. It is there for each and every one of us.